Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm your host, Dave Custy. With me today is Janet Marie Smith. Renowned architect and urban planner Janet Marie Smith was named the Los Angeles Dodgers Senior Vice President of Planning and Development on August 6, 2012. Smith is overseeing upgrades and enhancements to Dodger Stadium. This post reunites Smith with Dodger President Stan Kasten. Smith worked for Kasten in a similar position to create the Atlanta Braves' Turner Field and Atlanta Hawks' Phillips Arena. Smith is probably best known in the baseball world for her work on the influential Oriole Park at Camden Yards. Smith worked for the Orioles from 1989 to 94 as Vice President of Planning and Development during the design and construction of Oriole Park at Camden Yards. Opening in 1992, Camden Yards immediately became the standard bearer for a new wave of traditional baseball parks that have been built in subsequent years. Smith played an instrumental role in the design of the ballpark, creating a state-of-the-art, unique facility that blends with the urban context of downtown Baltimore, while taking inspiration from baseball parks built in the early 20th century. Prior to joining the Dodgers, Smith worked for the Baltimore Orioles as Vice President of Planning and Development from September 2009 to August 2012. In that role, Smith directed renovations and expansion of the Orioles' new spring training facility in Sarasota, Florida, as well as upgrades and enhancements to Oriole Park at Camden Yards to celebrate the park's 20th anniversary. From 2002 to 2009, she served as a Senior Vice President of Planning and Development for the Boston Red Sox, overseeing the preservation of historic Fenway Park and leading the program that placed this significant ballpark on the National Historic Register. From 1994 to 2000, Smith held the position of President of Turner Sports and Entertainment Development, a division of Turner Broadcasting System, and was the Vice President of Planning and Development for the Atlanta Braves. Her work in Atlanta helped transform the 1996 Olympic Stadium into Turner Field, home of the Braves, and she also oversaw the development of the Phillips Arena, home of the NBA Atlanta Hawks and the NHL Atlanta Thrashers. Smith also worked as senior advisor of planning and design with Baltimore-based Streva Brothers Eccles and Rouse on many of their development and rehab projects from Nashville, Tennessee to Providence, Rhode Island, including concept planning for the renovation of the Rose Bowl Stadium in Pasadena, California. She was also part of the Think Team, one of the final two teams in the competition for the World Trade Center site in New York City in 2002. In 2012, the Boston Baseball Writers honored Smith with a Special Achievement Award for her work at Fenway Park in 2011. She was named in the inaugural class of the sports business journal Game Changers, Women in Sports Business. Before working in sports, she worked on urban development projects, including Pershing Square in Los Angeles and Battery Park City in New York City, where she served as coordinator of architecture and design. She holds a master's degree in urban planning from City College of New York and a bachelor of architecture degree from Mississippi State University. She is an associate member of the Urban Land Institute, American Institute of Architects, and the American Planning Association. She also serves on the board of directors for Berklee College of Music in Boston and the advisory board for the University of Michigan Sports Management Program. A native of Jackson, Mississippi, she resides here in Baltimore with her husband, Bart Harvey, and their three children. Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio, Janet.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about yourself in your own words.
Well, I've had a wonderful chance to work on these great projects for so many years, and I feel so lucky. I moved to Baltimore not knowing this would wind up being 20-plus years of home for me, but rather my whole interest in Camden Yards and how it was going to change downtown really was so different from what was happening in sports in the late 80s, and it was just a treat to work for Larry Lucchino and be a part of that. And of course, he set me off on a great path. It's been, as you can tell from the recital of projects I've worked on, a great journey.
So let's go back a little bit. How did you get interested in architecture and urban planning?
Well, my dad's an architect, and no doubt that had a huge influence on me. But my father always really enjoyed cities and the way things fit together. And growing up in Mississippi, I can't say that I got to spend a lot of time in major cities in the country, but I had an affinity for them. And so as soon as I finished architecture school at Mississippi State, I went straight to New York, and that was just heaven to me. I just loved it. And during the time that I was working at Battery Park City, I had a chance to get my master's in urban planning at City College. one of the things that we had to do was to dissect a city, you know, almost the way in fifth grade you go and dissect a frog. Mm-hmm. We had to pick a city and really kind of, you know, look at trying to understand its economic, political, geographic changes. And Baltimore was my city. So I always felt like I knew it, you know, I just mm-hmm. felt like I had a feel for it. So, you know, 5 or 6 years later, when the opportunity to work for the Orioles came along, I just felt at home here. I just felt like I knew the place, and this Baltimore has so much character. You know, it just ekes of personality, and that really appealed to me. And it was great to have a chance to, you know, be with the Orioles, who are sort of part of that personality, and to find a way to give form and shape to the team.
Well, give us a little bit of evolution of how that came about. How did you get your Baltimore job?
Cinderella story. I was living on the West Coast, and I really enjoyed it, but I'd kind of had enough of that for the time being, and I wanted to move back to the East Coast when my project was finished, but I felt like I had one more fling in me before I went back to New York and settled down. That was what I guess I thought I was going to do. And I love going to baseball games. I'm not the kind of fan who necessarily hung on every pitch or could recount statistics ad nauseum to you, but I love the atmosphere and the sort of social quality of it. I love the way that our culture is reflected in sports and the way it's a mirror of our cities in many respects. So I was spending a lot of time in those days traveling around using baseball as an excuse to go out at night whenever I was in a city for a conference or a meeting. Somewhere along the way, I went to Memorial Stadium. I think it was 1988, the year that the Orioles, they won 108, lost 108 games that year. It was a really bad year for them. I remember that. But it was my first trip to Memorial Stadium, and I loved it. I just thought, oh, it's such a beautiful setting. But you know how you kind of kibitz with fans? And someone in the stands told me that they were building a ballpark downtown, and my first thought was, gee, this, I don't know why, this is a perfectly nice place right here. But then several months later, I had this eureka moment. I thought, well, you know what? If that's what they're going to do, if they're going to go into downtown and be a part of this urban renaissance that had already been begun by Jim Rouse and the city fathers, who Governor Schaefer and his predecessors who had started the Inner Harbor, I thought that could be great. That could be something really different than what was then considered, you know, the stadium model. So I wrote a letter to Larry Lucchino, and, you know, next thing I knew, I had a job and was packing my bags.
Yeah, the rest is history, right?
Yeah.
So what was it like when you first started out there?
Well, Larry's challenge to me was just spot on. I mean, he's so smart and so bright, and he had such a clarity to what he wanted to do. And sometimes the stars really do align in cities. And in this case, Larry Lucchino, who was president of the Orioles, wanted the ballpark to be this old-fashioned ballpark that fit into the city like Wrigley did to Chicago, or Fenway did to Boston, or Ebbets had to Brooklyn, or Forbes had to Pittsburgh. I mean, he had this clarity to what he wanted to do. And Schaefer, who by then was governor but had been mayor and lost the Colts and wasn't about to lose the Orioles, and so he's bending over backwards to figure out how to put a new stadium in for the Orioles. And probably his heart wasn't in the new stadium per se, but it was in downtown Baltimore. And so after all these studies were done to look at a location, Schaefer, as the story goes, just kind of kicked his foot in the door and said, look, we've just invested all this money in light rail to go into downtown Baltimore. We've got the MART train that terminates there. We've got, you know, 250,000 people who work in the core of the city every day and get in and out rush hour, no sweat. Why not put the park there? And of course, by then he had really become the cheerleader for Baltimore with the aquarium and the science center and the Inner Harbor and his advocacy for all things Charm City. So the combination of the downtown site and Larry's Lucchino's vision for a park that fit into the urban environment just made it a natural to do sort of the second generation of those older parks, having had all the multi-purpose stadium skipping era, really, you know.
Do you recall when you first got there, what was your first job to do?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing Larry said to me before he hired me, which was I enjoyed this question in the interview. He said, well, look, if, you know, why don't you go in the conference room and take a look at the plans that have been done to date and the master plan that's been done and just tell me what you think. You know, it gave us a chance to have a little bit of a rapport. It gave him a chance to see how I would respond to things. And what I could see was that RTKL had done this masterful job, I think, of finding a way of weaving the site around the park and really making it feel like it belonged. It belonged there. And HOK had just gotten started on the stadium designs themselves. And so I thought the first challenge was how do you marry that? You know, how do you really take the master plan, which was authored by one group of hands, and the sports architecture, and really make it feel like one. And so my primary task, not just the first assignment, but all through the time I worked for the Orioles during those years, was to make certain that the park not only fit into the neighborhood, but was really memorable, that there would be a lot of things in it that would be reference points for Baltimore and for the Orioles.
For instance, just give me a sample.
Well, it's, you know, some of the fun things are we took the foul pole from Memorial Stadium.
All right.
And that's at Camden Yards. We kept the warehouse, of course. You know, our thought was, gee, if we're going to be a part of the urban environment, why tear it down before we move in? Let's work with what we can. Of course, the warehouse has come to symbolize Camden Yards now. The tall wall in right field was something that our owner, Eli Jacobs, really cared about, having borrowed that from Ebbets Field. And the other Ebbets Field trick that we employed was the sun sign, which is on the top of the scoreboard, has an H and an E that light up to denote a hit or an error. Mm-hmm. That was borrowed from Ebbets Field. So, you know, we wanted to do things that, you know, that were about baseball, things that were about Baltimore.
It has become the template for the modern stadium. It's wonderful how you incorporated the warehouse there. It's almost like when you're a kid, you can hit a ball and break a window type of thing and all that. So what was it like when it was emerging? What was that like?
Well, it was wonderful, although I think, you know, I think we all held our breath until after that first game. And, you know, you just wondered, could it play? That was the one thing you couldn't test. You know, could you play a game there? And so it's just fabulous when, you know, Rick Sutcliffe recorded those final outs.
Yeah, I was reading that you had to dig it down below the street level there.
Well, it was that was an idea that HOK brought to the table, and it just really ended up being good on all fronts. It's set 16 feet below street level, so there's several advantages to that. When you walk in, half your fans are walking down and the other half are walking up. And so circulation is minimized. You know, the conflicts in circulation are minimized. It also means that it costs a lot less because your elevators and escalators and things aren't as long. But the thing that I really enjoyed about that decision from an urban planning perspective is that it keeps the building from towering over the neighbors. I mean, remember, the neighborhood around Camden Yards is largely 2 and 3-story row homes in Ridgely's Delight and the newer ones in Otterbein. And we didn't want it to seem like this mammoth spaceship thing coming up out of the ground. We really wanted it to be nestled in like the older parks. So depressing the playing field below grade gave us the advantage of having it appear to be, you know, 16 feet less high than it really is.
Well, it was excellent planning just to consider the neighborhood around you. But what was it like when it was done the first time that you walked out there and you saw it and you saw
I had the blessing of seeing it.
You see it through.
Yeah.
I know, I see it every day. You saw it, and it was that.
I think it was when we saw
April 4th with.
Saw it filled with people. I mean, that's actually the best feeling in the world when you work on a project like this. It's when you let go. You know, I guess it's like, you know, sending your kid off to college or something. It's when you let go. It's when you're finished, and now the rest of the world is enjoying it for what it's meant to be. And, you know, even today, you know, 20 plus years later, I never lose that thrill of seeing fans come into Camden Yards and taking it in. And I just get such a kick out of sitting in the stands and listening to fans around me talk about the ballpark. You know, it's great. You know, I love it when people point things out to me.
Yeah, that'll stay with you forever because there's more and more people coming from all over that never seen it before. They come here especially to see the ballpark. And I like just the little bits and pieces that you did. I like the idea that the bullpen is not on the field. People can just kind of overlook it, see all the people warming up and such.
Well, the idea of elevating those bullpens a little bit above the playing field was a suggestion we got from a fan.
Oh, really?
And Larry Lucchino really believed that that's where you get your best ideas. And it really is true. You can't pretend that, I don't care how long you've worked in a field, you're not an expert. The fans are the experts. Mm-hmm. You got to build it for the people who are going to come and enjoy it. So it's always just great to get those kinds of suggestions early enough in the building process when you can incorporate them.
Well, I'd like to have you back just to have a show about the building of Oriole Park at Camden Yard. But for now, let's talk about some of the other projects. When you worked for a local company, Strever Brothers.
Strever Brothers, Eccles and Rouse, yeah. And that was that was a lot of fun and very prescient in many ways because I was with Bill Strever working on the transformation of some of Baltimore's industrial buildings to housing and retail and office. And, his whole focus had been on growing the city and really developing the waterfront and making it something that people could enjoy again. It had been industry for so long, and industry had left the Inner Harbor, but the buildings were there. And so the challenge was, how do you get life back into them? Sort of the ultimate environmentally correct thing to do, mm-hmm. is how do you use the building again? So I learned a lot about not only renovations and rehabs, but about the use of historic tax credits. And so in 2002, when Larry Lucchino, by then, who was president of the Red Sox, called me and asked me if I could come and take a look at Fenway Park and see if I could help them figure out a way to map out a way to save that 100-year-old ballpark, mm-hmm. The things that I had learned from Bill were really instrumental in doing that. And Strever Brothers played a really significant role in helping us map out ways that we could make that building work and ways that we could work with the National Park Service to put it on the National Historic Register while not freezing it like an object under glass. How could we make it something that could be historic but still have new life?
What were some of the places that you worked on here in Baltimore?
Well, our offices were at Tide Point, which was the old Procter & Gamble plan. And so I had a chance to work on that just before we moved in. Bill had already acquired the property and redeveloped most of it. Now it's Under Armour's headquarters, which is wonderful to see Baltimore grow a company mm-hmm. like that. He was always so prolific, and there were so many things he was interested in that it gave me a chance to work on everything from, Clipper Mill in Hamden to Belvedere Square to the projects that he was doing in Rhode Island. So it's just a nice potpourri of things that all had a commonality, which was they were part of the city.
Fenway Park, tell us about.
Well, Fenway Park had long been written off as history, because it was so small. Fenway was built with only about 34,000 seats. And so in the era of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, when teams were moving into parks that had 50,000 and 60,000 seats, it just seemed it was an impossibility to ever compete with the other Major League Baseball teams because of its size. And so literally for decades, the Red Sox looked at ways of replacing Fenway Park. And somehow things just never got off the ground. Mm-hmm. And so by the time that Larry Lucchino and his partners Tom Werner and John Henry bought the club in 2002, not much had happened to Fenway in the previous 10 years because they'd been working so hard to plan for a new ballpark in that neighborhood. And so in some ways there was a lot of low-hanging fruit, as Larry used to call it, when we did some things early on that expanded the footprint of Fenway without changing it. We went to the city and we asked for permission to use the adjacent street, Yawkey Way, mm-hmm. as an extension of our concourse. We asked the city for permission to build seats on top of the Green Monster, the big tall wall in left field, and they hang out over the sidewalk on Lansdowne Street. Then we took the two buildings that sit on the same block as Fenway and essentially appended them to Fenway, getting permission from the Boston City Zoning and Appeals to punch holes through them and grab that space and use it for Fenway purposes. So we were able to build big new restrooms, new kitchens, new commissary, new hangout places, new offices, just by using the real estate that was already there. So in some ways, Fenway was almost more of a planning challenge than it was an architectural challenge.
Mm-hmm. And this was 2002, did you say?
I started working for them in 2002, and the Red Sox spent about 10 years on the renovations, doing a little bit each offseason. You know, in baseball, you can't just work year-round. You got to have your plans and construction ready to start when the season ends in October and be ready to play again at the end of March of the next year. So things have to happen very fast.
Mm-hmm. I'm taking it all around in your career, so it's not in any chronological order. Tell me a little bit about your work at Atlanta.
Well, Atlanta was a real kick because of the Olympics. I think when Atlanta woke up and saw they'd won the Olympics, probably no one was more shocked than the city itself, you know, and all of a sudden they're like, wow, we got to build all this stuff. And so the Braves had been wanting a new home for some time. They played in the multi-purpose Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. And so like the Falcons, they had wanted out and wanted into a baseball-only facility. So all of a sudden here, they had this opportunity to be a part of the Olympic Stadium and have, you know, a cost-free, debt-free facility, which is phenomenal for anybody. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's ever been done before. And Stan Kasten, who was their president, worked really hard to make certain that they got a deal that would allow the Braves to be at the table when the Olympic Stadium was designed so that it could be designed for baseball. And then it was built to accommodate 80,000 fans for the Olympics. But then immediately after the Olympics were over in 1994, then it was almost 40,000 seats were taken out to create what we now know as Turner Field. Mm-hmm. And I find it somewhat sad and a bit ironic that the Braves are now talking about leaving Turner Field. It's less than 20 years old. But I think it says a lot about location. I think in many ways it's not the park that's driven them to that conclusion, but rather the fact that there's not the kind of urban scene and excitement around it that they would like. And that was very much a result of the rapid pace of the Olympics. You know, the Olympic Organizing Committee didn't feel they had time to research and explore alternatives. They really needed to build on a piece of land the city already owned. So I watched that with interest because it's, you know, having now worked in baseball for a little over 20 years, I've seen a lot of stuff, but I never expected to see a building I'd worked on come and go.
In terms of the Olympics there, have they been able to utilize the stadiums that they built for that? Because I remember when London was getting the Olympics, there were all these other countries saying, don't get it, because we had to build this thing and haven't used it since and that kind of stuff.
Well, you're right. They turn into white elephants if they're not conceived of with a future. And I think Atlanta did a really good job of conceiving their projects as having a future. But moreover, they did a fabulous job of creating things during the Olympics that have lasted decades since. The Centennial Olympic Park downtown has become a real centerpiece of the center city. It's caused everyone from Coca-Cola on to build museums along its perimeter and really treat it as the jewel of the downtown Atlanta. So there are many things besides the Olympic facilities that remain from the Olympics that are a positive contribution to the city.
So let's go now to Sarasota, Florida. Tell us about your work.
Oh, what fun. That was just great. Well, it was a little bit of a lark, but one I just professionally, I couldn't have enjoyed more. I was just thrilled when I had a chance to work for Peter Angelos years after I'd left the Orioles. And worked, you know, had already done the things you just asked me about. I'd already worked for the Red Sox, the Braves, and Bill Strever. And Mr. Angelos was looking to build a new spring training facility in Sarasota. He'd already put the deal together that gave the Orioles the rights to both the stadium and the practice fields that the White Sox had built but had left, and also keep the minor league complex that they had in Sarasota. So it was three different buildings, that project coincided with the 20th anniversary of Camden Yards. So my job had, you know, two assignments. One was to, you know, update Camden Yards, and the other was to get the spring training facility going. And Peter Angelos just was passionate about how we approach this. We had signed a 30-year lease, and he had handpicked Sarasota himself because he thought it was such a great place for Oriole fans to go for spring training because it's so family-oriented. He was very interested in seeing Oriole fans have a place to go that was easy to get to. And we have to think about it. In baseball, a lot of teams were being lured by Arizona. And Arizona was offering a lot more money than the Florida teams were. Mm-hmm. But Peter Angelos really thought it was important to the Oriole fans that it be easy and convenient to get to. He thought it was important to the team that it be easy and convenient to get to. Mm-hmm. And indeed, they use those facilities for rehab. A player goes on the disabled list, and the first thing they do is ship him down to Sarasota. Well, right. It's an easy flight away. And Sarasota is just a beautiful community. It's got, you know, it's got like the best beaches in the world. I mean, seriously, the best beaches in the world.
It's funny about that. And I was looking at places thinking, well, you know, in a perfect world, if I could like retire to Florida, where would I go? And I picked Sarasota because Sarasota has an opera company. They have theater companies. They have classical music. They have all sorts of arts things to do. It's not just, you know, sitting around on the beach.
You're absolutely right.
It's like, what? Look at all this stuff there. And like you say, great beaches. Great location on the West Coast there.
Their main street is as vibrant and
great restaurants.
Oh my goodness, you can eat so well. And it's you're right, it really is just a great cultural place. Plus it's got fabulous hotels, you know, everything from, you know, a Motel 6 to the Ritz-Carlton within 15 blocks of the little Ed Smith Stadium where the Orioles play. So it just couldn't be better. And I loved it because it was so challenging to try to figure out how to take this fairly nondescript 1980s stadium and the clubhouse and transform them into something that had some real personality and was a real reflection of the Orioles. And Peter Angelos was so interested in everything we did, and he had so many ideas that he wanted to see manifested in this park. And I don't know if you've had the opportunity to see it, but it is just, it's just, the scale is just wonderful. And it's got these, you know, beautiful arches designed by David Schwartz Architects out of Washington. And they worked really closely with us to come up with something that felt like it belonged in Florida, but it felt like it belongs to the Orioles. You know, it's like great. A little Camden Yard South.
I don't think you could have found a better place to go down. Oh, so you have to invite me down sometime.
It's fabulous.
Well, maybe you can invite me to Dodgers Spring.
We talk about that too. The Orioles minor league clubhouse is in this beautiful facility that's been used for decades by various baseball teams. And I don't think any team's got the facilities that the Orioles do in Florida. It's just beautifully done. And Andy McPhail, who was with the team at the time and really helped Peter Angelos put this deal together, along with Alan Rifkin, had a real focus on keeping the low minors in a location where they could focus on their work, so that you didn't have your single-A guys getting mixed up with what was going on with triple-A and the major league team. And so having the two complexes on separate sites really worked for the way the team was looking to grow.
So now you have state-of-the-art facilities. Walk to everything, right?
Well, and Buck Showalter, who happens to have the same degree I do, we both graduated from Mississippi State.
I was going to talk about that.
Anyway, you know, Buck Showalter cared so much about this facility and how it came together, and so it was really nice to have his input on something, because he was focused on everything from how players trained to the atmosphere that they walked into and to how they would respond to the facility. And one of my favorite Buck Showalter stories is that after we had been housed at Ed Smith Stadium for 3 or 4 weeks, he gave his players a pop quiz on the complex to see what they could remember. He had everything on that pop quiz from, what are our retired numbers? What are the dimensions of the Camden Yards field, which of course mimicked the one in Baltimore? What are the words of inspiration that are over the lockers in the clubhouse themselves? So he was really funny about it. He said, I thought some of these guys would whip through it in 10 minutes and turn it in with a bunch of blanks. He said, there's some of them working on it 70 minutes in trying
to
get it right.
That's great. That's terrific. You recall anybody who was outstanding?
No, okay. I don't think he shared with me who was spending the most time on it. He just shared the questions with me.
Let's go back then. You opened it up. What about Mississippi State University? You're from Mississippi.
I am from Mississippi, and I was so lucky to go to architecture school there while the school was new. My class was the third class to graduate from architecture school, so it meant that all of our professors had come from somewhere else, and they'd all come together at the same time. So not that tenure is bad or that longevity and deep roots are anything to find fault with, but there was an energy about it because we were all new. Mm-hmm. And it was just great fun. And Bill McMahon, who was the dean of the school, really believed that if we were going to teach a bunch of kids architecture in Starkville, Mississippi, we better find some way to get them exposed to something more than just the cow pastures. So every semester we took a fairly serious field trip and went to, you know, Chicago or San Francisco or New Orleans. And he had a lecture series that honestly would rival anything you see at any other school in America. And then we spent our fifth year of the program in Jackson rather than Starkville. And I always thought that was brilliant because at, you know, 22, you'd had enough of being in a small college town, and it was nice to be in an urban setting, as urban as Jackson is, and deal with some of those issues and just to be in a different place.
So that's where you were born, in Jackson?
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's very good. Coming home and doing that. So what about Buck Showalter? You mentioned you have the same degree as he did.
Yeah, well, he and I both laugh about it. I think he and I both took longer than the average student to get our degrees.
We won't go into that.
But that's all right. We both got it. We can both hang it on the wall and claim it.
That's very good.
And I think Mississippi State claims us both. So I think it all worked out well in the end.
Go Bulldogs, right?
Yeah.
Your current job. Tell us about
that. Oh, golly, I've got the most fun job you can imagine right now. I've been working for the Los Angeles Dodgers for about the last year and a half. Stan Kasten, who was my boss in Atlanta, took the position of Dodgers president in May of last year when the Guggenheim partners, Magic Johnson and Peter Guber, bought the club. And so I am commuting to L.A. every week from Charm City.
All right. And so you still live here?
I still live here. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm working on the renovations to 53-year-old Dodger Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been so much fun. It's a fabulous place. I feel lucky to have known it as a fan first, because when I lived in Los Angeles in the early 1980s, I lived in the neighborhood adjacent Dodger Stadium, and that was kind of my backyard. Mm-hmm. I went there all the time. So,
did you ever think that you would go
in its
front yard?
No idea I had that I would ever get to come in the front door. I always thought I'd be slipping in the side panes. But it's been just fabulous because, you know, I was a real fan, and I knew that building. And I didn't know the fancy seats. My budget didn't allow fancy seats.
No,
so I really felt that I understood the culture of that park. It's so different from any other stadium I've ever been in. It's literally carved into the hillside of Chavez Ravine. Every level you enter at grade. So the top deck, you park your car, you walk in, there are palm trees at the front door. You know, it's not like waving up in the air like most places. And, of course, you've got these glorious views of the San Gabriel Mountains beyond the outfield. And if you turn 180 degrees, you're just a stone's throw from downtown Los Angeles. It's just been so much fun. It's a really different kind of building to work on. A lot of horticulture to deal with. We've got a full-time arborist and his staff. It's
like
this botanical garden around it. And I'm enjoying the landscape component. Mostly I'm enjoying the Dodger organization and their fans. It's just, it's a really electric time to be there. It's fun. It's always fun to be a part of something new, and this is no different. It's just wonderful, and I've enjoyed being reunited with Stan Kasten and Bob Wolf again, too.
What are some of the improvements or renovations that you're doing there?
As I said a moment ago, Guggenheim Partners bought the club in May of 2012. So this past April 2013, was their first opening day, and they wanted to make a splash, and they wanted fans to know they cared. So here we were in this 50-plus-year-old building, which, you know, that's not ancient like Wrigley or Fenway, but it's also not new and modern like, you know, Camden or AT&T Park in San Francisco or Petco in San Diego or, you know, pick any one of the other 12 that have been built since Camden Yards opened. And many times owners find it tempting to focus on where the money is, the suite level, the club level, the dugout seats. And those have been upgraded in recent years by the previous ownership groups. And so what they asked me and my team to do was to focus on Joe Fan, you know, to get in there and figure out how to do the basic stuff like put in new restrooms, get rid of the lines for restrooms. So we double the size of 28 restrooms in that building, but all new restrooms for men and women, and did a family restroom, at least two on every level. We redid concessions, team stores, widened the concourses, put in new scoreboards, new sound system, Wi-Fi, cell service, you know, the stuff that touches every fan, not just not just your season ticket holders or your corporate guys who are, you know, the money group, but literally the things that touch every fan. And it was a whirlwind. We bit off probably more than we ever should have in one single off season, but we had a great team of people, and Hunt Construction did a yeoman's job on the construction. So we did well over $100 million worth of design and construction in that short period of time between the 1st of November and the end of March.
Wow.
It was amazing. It was like a roller coaster. It was just amazing. My husband, Bart, came out to visit me at spring break with the kids. Or maybe it was a long holiday weekend in February, and he looked at the place, and we had the entire lower bowl torn out because we took it out so we could build ourselves a basement and expand the clubhouse. The scoreboards were down, the sound system was out, every restroom in the place had been gutted so that we could build new ones. And it was sobering because we were 45 days away from opening, and he said, "Honey, I don't think you should come home." It was just fun. It was fun to stay out there. And we literally were working 7 days a week, about 18 hours a day, and we got done.
Most everything is done. Is there going to be more?
Well, we got everything done that we did for that off season, and we do have more. We didn't get to everything we wanted to do, obviously, in a single off season.
Sure.
So Stan Kasten has a wish list of things that we're focused on at the moment, and we're looking to try and get building permits lined up. And with a little luck, we'll start construction this month and finish up some of the things that we had planned for, particularly the outfield areas, by this the end of this March.
Just tell us about living in L.A. I mean, it's kind of be a culture shock from Baltimore to go into
LA. I don't know. Fellows Point and Echo Park have a lot in common.
Really?
They're both kind of funky, artsy places. And, I think L.A.'s, the image of L.A. in most people's mind is this enormous city, this very horizontal where everybody's in their cars and it takes 45 minutes to go everywhere. And I can't tell you how different my life in LA is from that. You know, I live in many neighborhoods are just super walkable with lots of funky little stores and shops and great eating and beautiful parks to run in. And it's not Beverly Hills centric. It's not Malibu centric. It's, you know, it's about living in the neighborhood you're in. And Dodger Stadium is in these wonderful neighborhoods, and they're just full of all kinds of artists and musicians. And as I said, really good food. So it's been a lot of fun. You know, I can't say that it's all that different from being in Hamden or, you know, Fells Point.
Fells Point. Yeah. You still live in Baltimore, though.
Yes, I do. I've got three kids, one who's in college now, but the other two are in high school. And I might pry my husband loose to go out and have an adventure with me, but I think those kids want to graduate where they are.
You're happy to stay here for a
while?
Well,
we've loved it. I mean, Baltimore's just it's a wonderful city. It's really a very manageable size, but yet it's a real city. It's right there on the Amtrak line. It's easy to get up and down the East Coast, whether you're going as far north as, you know, Boston or Hartford, or whether you're headed down to Richmond or D.C., it's just convenient. And flying in and out of BWI is as easy as flying anywhere ever is weekly. And, of course, it's just so affordable compared to most other cities in America. And so we've been the great beneficiary of that and its history. And, you know, I love the neighborhoods and their charm. And, you know, really, it's aptly named. It really is Charm City.
Where do you live in Baltimore?
We live just north of Johns Hopkins in Roland Park.
Wonderful.
It's an Olmsted neighborhood. And, aficionado of parks and a student of planning, I can't help but love our neighborhood as much as I do the
That's
house.
Terrific. Let me throw this out. 2014 World Series Dodgers versus Orioles.
Oh, wouldn't that be a blast? Oh, I would just
love it. You could go to every game and you wouldn't have to get a hotel room.
I could go to every game and I could cheer for both teams. It just would be a blast. Oh, my goodness.
Well, thank you very much for coming here. I really appreciate it. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, I can't think of a thing. If I could talk all day about this stuff.
So well, that's what I'd like you to come back, and since you're just 15 minutes away, basically,
that
you can come back, and we can talk about architecture more, about the O's. We can talk about anything you really want to talk about, because this has been, you've been terrific.
Thank you.
And even, I have to mention, this is recorded on December 13th, 2013, and it's your birthday. You
yes,
came here on your birthday. So happy birthday from everybody
you.
And all the listeners, I'm sure, too. And I really appreciate you coming over here to Baltimore Internet Radio.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Custy, and I've been talking to Janet Marie Smith, the Senior Vice President of Planning and Development for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Thank you for listening, and this is Baltimore Internet Radio.